Ask the cap, let me put you on game. Ask the cap, look at all that you could gain. Business moves, loans, and grants, it's all a part of the game. You could learn all of this, let the Queen Sheba explain. Ask the cap, let me put you on.
Well, thank you for joining this episode of Access to Cap. We are super excited to have conscious conversations about economic empowerment with our guest, Glenn Davis from Liberty Bank. We will ask Glenn to introduce himself to the audience and to the Access to Cap team. And as we begin to talk a little bit about access to capital and have conscious conversations about this current climate, I promise to be kind about the banking industry, but super excited to have him here as he introduced himself in his role at Liberty Bank, not just in Connecticut, but also Massachusetts. Why don't you talk to the people about what you do for the community and the work that you do at Liberty?
Okay. Thank you, Sansaray. It's a pleasure to be here and this podcast for Axe to Cap. Glenn Davis, I am the first vice president, community development and CRA officer at Liberty Bank. And in my role, I've been there going on 13 years. And in my particular role, I like to say that I'm the face of the community to the bank and the face of the bank to the community. So I'm engaged in a number of really community development initiatives. Liberty Bank is celebrating, next month we'll be celebrating our 200th birthday. So we are really the oldest and the largest community bank in the country.
Nice.
So, yeah, so we've been around for 1875, I guess that's, no, 1825.
Woo.
Can't count. 1825. And so, and as a community bank, we are the largest mutual bank. And as a mutual bank, the biggest difference is you have stock banks and mutual banks. Mm-hmm. Mutual banks are owned exclusively by our depositors, so we really don't have shareholders, which really essentially means that we don't go into Wall Street, we don't go into the capital markets, we don't have shareholders as a means of raising capital. In my particular role, so I cover on the retail side, I'm really instrumental in making sure that we have products and services that cater to lower income individuals and geographies. Mm. On the small business side, we've developed programs that really cater to the small business community. And again, with the focus on low and moderate income individuals. And then on the commercial side, again, just making sure that there's community development loans to help revitalize the community and then providing investments. So my role as the CRA officer is to ensure that we are doing a commensurate level of investments in our community.
Nice.
With that, every bank really has a CRA officer and a CRA mandate, CRA being the acronym for Community Reinvestment Act. Mm-hmm. That particular act in itself requires banks to make their products and services available to all segments of the community, with particular emphasis on low and moderate income communities. So that's really my focus.
Okay. So for an entrepreneur or small business, why should they choose a community bank such as Liberty over a larger bank such as Bank of America or M&T?
So I'll just say a larger bank. I won't name names. but
that's a plug for Bank of America. M&T, you're welcome.
So, I mean, that's a great question, because as a community bank, all of our decisions are made locally. Mm. When you look at M&T, you look at some of the larger institutions, those decisions are really made not even on a regional level, they're made on a national level.
Right.
And that's important that even as it relates to the larger banks, even their the sponsorships and their donations are made on a larger level, and they're made particularly to large national organizations as opposed to a community bank like Liberty. We really are at a very local level. So we make all of our decisions on a local level, whether it's small business, mortgage lending, everything's on a local level.
Okay, I love that. So for a startup organization who may not know what to do to begin their financial portfolio, what advice would you give to a young aspiring entrepreneur who just opened up their small business and don't know where to go from here?
Well, you know, I think the first thing is to really be plugged into, there's a tremendous ecosystem and network that I think many entrepreneurs are not aware of.
Okay.
And so understanding that ecosystem is so important, because at every level and every stage of that entrepreneur's growth, there's assistance that they need to be made aware of. For example, you have the Small Business Administration with their Small Business Development Centers and their Women's Business Development Center. Mm-hmm. They provide a tremendous network of free counseling, mm-hmm. ongoing counseling, and technical assistance that you really can't get from a bank. And then you also have non-bank lenders right. in the community. And then, of course, having Liberty Bank. At Liberty Bank, for even a startup or a new entrepreneur, we have an Academy for Small Business program, which is really a 10-class, 5-week program. Twice a week, they come through, they learn about banking, tax accounting, financial reporting, time management, risk management. At the end of that program, we provide a $5,000 line of credit. Mm-hmm. And that line of credit is really just meant to be seed capital. In many instances, new entrepreneurs, that's really all they need is some seed capital.
Right, right. So if we're talking about the Small Business Academy, you also have what you call Liberty Foundation to mm-hmm. help insert some capital into some of these organizations. Can you talk a little bit about the services and support that Liberty Foundation also provides?
Okay. So there are two things. This Liberty Bank Foundation is a separate foundation of the bank. Mm-hmm. And that foundation's mission is really to provide grants to nonprofit organizations in our community. Mm-hmm. But in addition to that, you know, because the foundation is also limited in terms of the amount of money that they can provide. They're providing money primarily to nonprofit organizations.
Okay.
But also part of the mandate as a CRA officer, we have CRA investments. And those investments, we inject capital and we deploy our capital into CDFIs or community development financial institutions.
Nice.
Because a bank can't be all things to all people.
Right.
And to the extent that we can't be all things to all people, we inject capital into organizations that can then deploy those funds at the ground level to communities that need it.
I love that.
So while, you know, the bank, if you think about it as a three-pronged animal, if you will, you have the bank proper that can do small business and mortgage lending and commercial lending. You have the foundation that does all of our grants. And then you have our CRA investments that actually will deploy capital into nonprofit organizations or community development or financial institutions that then deploy that capital to needed segments of the community.
Nice. So while we're talking about the community, what are some of the things that you all have done to build and repair the trust amongst banking institutions such as Liberty in our marginalized community? Because I can remember back in the day where my auntie and my granddad and all of them would wrap their money in foils and throw it in a freezer or put it up under the mattress. So talk to me about why we should now, within this current climate
sure.
and administration, trust our resources in these institutions.
Well, no, and that's reasonable. I think every generation should ask that question
mm-hmm.
and critically ask the question and critically think through where the dollars are being deployed in
right.
the community. To a certain extent, one bank is no different than another bank. But every deposit that we make, and that's why I think the real big distinction between a community bank and a stock bank, mm-hmm. because as a community bank, our focus, in fact, Liberty Bank's mantra is to really to make and to improve the lives of our customers, our teammates, and our communities for generations to come.
Mm-hmm.
And so I really gravitate to that, because what we do with our capital is we really make sure that we put it into the community, and we're really extracting. So the money that we're putting back into the community are dollars that the community has actually deposited into the bank. And so I think that all the community, every segment of the community should be a mandate from the community say, okay, we're putting our dollars into your institution, what are you doing in the community?
Right.
And there should be a proven track record. And so that track record in all banks, and in particular, the CRA, we're examined every 3 years by the state regulator and by our federal regulator. In our case, Liberty's case, is the Federal Deposit Insurance Company. So there's a rating that you can get for lending services and investments. And that rating could be substantially noncompliant, needs improvement, satisfactory, or outstanding. Mm-hmm. So I'm really proud and honored to say that for Liberty Bank, to your question, Liberty Bank has an outstanding rating, not just overall, right, but in all three of those tests. And that really is a testament that the FDIC is saying that we're doing an outstanding job in deploying our funds and our resources into the communities that need it most.
I love that. Yeah. I love that. But, you know, for us, communities of color, we struggle with everything that's happening right now between DOGE and Social Security being impacted and DEI being affected. Talk to me a little bit about some of the work that you've done to combat redlining and to reassure your customers that you are here for the community and that you put the work in to repair those relationships.
Sure. I mean, and that's reasonable. That's fair. Mm-hmm. So over the years, Liberty has really structured, and part of my role is to sit on committees where we actually are looking to make special purpose credit programs mm-hmm. available. And that really means that our management has made a commitment to marginalized communities. And to the extent that we did not have products or services that would meet those needs, mm-hmm. we would convene a committee and specifically design and just really just be very kind of crazy, if you will, in terms of how we develop programs. And we would develop programs specifically. So we have, on the residential side, we have a Good Neighbor program. Mm. And that Good Neighbor program really offers a 50% basis, 50 basis point discount off of the market rate. It's basically a 100% financed program.
Oh, wow.
And then, you know, if you know anything about the mortgage company, anything greater than 80% loan to value, you have to have mortgage insurance.
Right.
Well, Liberty will cover that mortgage insurance. So essentially, with very minimal down, 3% down from the borrower, mm-hmm. they can basically get a 90% mortgage and not have to pay mortgage insurance.
I love that.
At a 50 basis point discount. So that's, you know, those are the types of programs. And then hiring the right type of teammates that know the community, understand the community. And it's about building trust. You know, my role, I've been around for 13 years, but prior to that, I've established, had an established history of lending. So I think having the right teammates involved in the community and then having management to support a lot of the initiatives.
Right.
I mean, we couldn't have achieved an outstanding if management had not given me the, I won't say the checkbook, but the
right.
checkbook
right.
to actually invest those types of dollars in the community.
I love the buy-in from the top. So as we talk about investing and reinvesting, how important is credit for these individuals? You know, I was going there, right? Because for some of us, we had phone bills and light bills and all kind of bills in our name since we was 5 years
right.
old. So how do we get in front of ensuring that our credit is where it needs to be to take advantage of some of these resources that you have available?
Yeah, that's an important question, because I see so often good projects never get off the ground because
right.
of credit.
Right.
And at every bank, including Liberty, I mean, credit is key.
Mm-hmm.
So two things to that is, going back to your previous question, so one of the things that Liberty has done as it relates to developing special purpose credit programs mm-hmm. is also designing certain products that will lower the credit threshold. So we'll have our standard threshold. But on the small business side and the residential side, we have certain products where we lower the credit threshold.
Nice.
That helps individuals that may not be at that higher tier to really obtain the credit. And that's important because in our community, oftentimes we go to hard money lenders and, you know, we find ourselves, you know, the cost of capital is extreme.
Right.
So having those programs really helps that.
Mm-hmm.
The other side is I can't say enough about help. People really have to be actively managing their credit. Mm-hmm. And when I say actively managing their credit, there's services that you can engage, but you have to be mindful of those because right. a lot of them really aren't what they
right.
positioned right. to be. So yeah, I'll say it like that. Right. So you really have to. So credit is key.
Yeah.
And you just have to actively manage that.
Right. And how important is it for young entrepreneurs or startups who understand the difference between their personal credit and their business credit? Because oftentimes you see, and I see, individuals trying to fund their dreams and their businesses off of their personal credit and their personal finances. So talk to me and to the audience about how important it is to keep that separate.
Yeah, that I see it all the time, and I really understand it. I understand the dynamic because oftentimes we're not able to go into the banks to get the credit from a right. business perspective.
Right.
But I think, and I know that because of this ecosystem that I talked about earlier, mm-hmm. there really are channels and avenues where you can get funded. Even right. if you can't get funded at a traditional bank level, there are ways to get the project funded.
Right.
But it's really imperative that you keep your business and your personal credit separate because, I talked to a gentleman a couple of weeks ago. Great business, making money, mm-hmm. But his credit is, kind of tanked mm-hmm. because he's funding his business through his credit.
Right.
And so he's, and the other thing that I see to this point is how we fund in our community. We fund our businesses via credit cards.
Right.
And the thing with credit cards, revolving debt really is based on utilization.
Right.
And so when you're funding your business based on credit cards, your utilization will always be high. And even if you're paying your bills on time,
right.
you'll have a poor credit rating.
Mm.
That's the crazy part about it because it's not based on payment history or payment record is only like a third of your credit report,
right.
credit score.
Right.
The other third and a significant portion is your utilization.
Right.
And anytime you go over 30% of your balance or your available credit,
right.
then that's really when you have problems.
That means when y'all max your credit cards out, it is not good to max your credit cards out because your credit tanks, your credit score decreases. It doesn't
yeah.
increase. It decreases.
Right. And the people will always say, but I pay my bills on time. That's not the issue.
Right. Right.
It's the utilization.
And so talk about that credit mix. And I know it's kind of like a special sauce and a recipe to it. But if you had to high level say what the credit mix should be in order for a startup or a young entrepreneur to really try to lay a solid foundation for building their credit, what would that be?
So I think. Couple things. First, you need to understand credit, and you need to understand why you need the credit.
Right.
So, in the credit world, on the business side, you have a term debt and you have revolving debt or a line of credit.
Right.
And so, you never want to, you want your line of credit to purchase inventory because you're going to take that inventory, bring it in, and you'll convert that to cash, and at some point, you'll pay back that line of credit.
Right.
So you want that on the business side. If you're trying to buy a piece of equipment, you don't want to use a line of credit for that. You really want to use term debt because that has a long shelf life, if you will.
Right.
Well, the same is true on the personal side. The best form of credit, I think, is probably term debt.
Mm.
Your mortgage, a personal loan that you're paying monthly payments on, mm-hmm. because that's a stable form. And to the extent that you're making your payments on time, that really, I think, has the highest credibility in terms of your credit rating.
Mm.
Because then you're not subject to a utilization issue.
Right.
Now, if you have a credit card, and you could have 20 credit cards.
Right.
With, if you have 20 credit cards and your balances on all 20 are only, let's say, 5 or 10% of the available credit,
mm-hmm.
and you're paying your bills on time, mm-hmm. you have perfect credit.
Mm-hmm.
If you have 20 credit cards and you are 80% of the credit limit, you will have poor credit,
right.
even if you're paying on time.
Right.
So from an entrepreneur's perspective, I think to the extent that you align your credit request mm-hmm. with the need and always think about term debt being kind of the best form.
Love that. So representation matters.
Mm-hmm.
Talk to us about what led you down the journey of banking and, you know, understanding the journey of money and how beneficial it could be for you and our community.
Okay. Long, long time ago.
In school was it 7 years ago?
Our fathers were fourth. So interesting. So my journey, I graduated from Fisk University, you know, the greatest historically black college in the country. That's okay. That's all right. So I graduated with a degree in management and a minor in economics.
Mm-hmm.
So my first job out of college was at a bank. And I chose banking because I had several job offers, but banking to me provided the opportunity for me to learn everything about every industry. So I wouldn't be pigeonholed by manufacturing or aerospace. So I could learn about every industry, the financial workings of every. And so that really was my the catalyst for me going into banking.
Yeah.
And in that role, I started out in a management training program. I've done branch management. So I learned kind of on the ground floor about, you know, branch networking. And so from there, I've kind of moved. I've been on the commercial side. I've been on the asset management side, which is really interesting because that's really where you're doing asset and recovery. You're doing collections on a commercial level.
Right.
So I've done that. And, you know, and my career has always been around economic development. So that's really, so for me, banking just provides that one platform to learn everything and anything about every industry.
I love that.
And that's really what kind of motivated me into banking. And now I just feel, you know, I feel my role is really a calling.
Mm.
You know, I feel, and the other thing I really love about banking is that I've been privileged. Even now I can drive in certain parts of this community in Connecticut and Western Mass. I could go into other parts of the country and I could tell my children, I financed that project.
That's amazing.
And so that was something that I love that.
That's
that
amazing.
To me is legacy.
I love that. I love that, especially given the impact that Black Wall Street has had on our community and the dismantling of it. So talk to me about how do we rebuild that for our communities? Because we when we walk in banks, we still don't always see people that look like us.
That's true. But everyone that doesn't look like us doesn't suggest that they're against us.
Say that one more time.
everyone that doesn't look like us is not an indication that they're against us.
Right.
And so, one, I think we should approach the bank not in a defensive way,
right,
but that you have something to offer to the bank. And then, you know, I think put a demand. When I say a demand, it doesn't have to be, you know, hostile, arrogant, boisterous, but put a demand on your deposits.
When I
look at our community, the one thing that's, and this is another reason that I was led into banking, because the one challenge that we have in our communities are always have been disinvested in.
Right.
But the one thing about our community is that unless there is a system to collect, store, and distribute capital, those communities will always be impoverished.
Mm.
And so I think it's important, you know, there was a time that, you know, we had more black banks than we have now.
Right.
And so that's the process of collecting and storing that capital.
Right.
So you need to have a repository where that can happen. And then, you know, with that comes the deployment and investment in your community.
Right.
Also, along with that, and, you know, I'm really privileged to be at Liberty Bank because notwithstanding the current environment, there has not been a vocal change against diversity, equity, and inclusion.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's something that's real big at Liberty. So
right.
We believe in making sure that our teammates bring a diverse perspective to the table, and they live by that.
Beautiful.
So And so when I think about that in terms of the banking, and that's really important, that's essential. You know, I can speak the language of the community, and that's why I said early on, I believe that I'm the face of the bank to the community, but I'm also the face of the community to the bank.
Right. I love that. So for a young, aspiring, recent college graduate or a young individual who may be looking for a career in banking, what advice would you give them in terms of how to break into that industry? Or what do they need to do first? What do they need to know about it in order to pursue a career in that industry?
Unless you come out of an Ivy League school or you have, you know, you have a degree in finance and you're looking at investment banking. So, well, let me back up, because I think you have to also understand when you talk about banking, that's such a broad topic.
Right.
So assuming that you're not talking about an investment banker,
right.
Investment banker, particularly on Wall Street, stocks and bonds, dealing with that. So you really, I think at every level, you have to understand that it may take working at the ground level.
Mm-hmm.
I started in banking in a management training program.
Mm.
I think that's a good, you know, coming out of college, that's a good place to land.
Right.
Because from there, you can really get a chance to take and get a view of the full landscape of where you want to go. And you may not, you know, it's just because you're in a management training program, it's designed really to probably, that trajectory is probably branch management.
Mm-hmm.
But you're seeing all scopes and all perspectives of the bank.
Right.
And you may end up in commercial lending or commercial underwriting.
Right.
One thing I can tell you now is that what I see is that there are a low number of poor representation of African Americans, people of color, in underwriting.
Mm-hmm.
Underwriters are key to making the deals work.
Right.
Now, the numbers are the numbers.
Right.
But I think, and one of the things that I think we bring to the table is, you can look at the numbers, but if you understand the dynamic of the community, that helps explain and bring context to the numbers.
Right. Right.
And so, you know, underwriting, commercial underwriting, I think is a untapped opportunity for people of color.
I love that. So talk a little bit, stay right there for me and talk a little bit about risk management, because most people don't understand the risk management side. An area of the bank that actually insulates and protects both the client, the customer, as well as the bank. So talk a little bit about risk management.
So, yeah, when you talk about, people need to understand banks, every bank, they are risk adverse.
Right.
I mean, I got it. I mean, if I put my $10 in the bank, I want to make sure I can go back and get my $10.
Right.
And so to the extent that a bank is just lending money without any concern with controls, then chances are they're not going to have that money. Well, that's your money that you're depositing.
Right.
And so from a risk management perspective, that, you know, entrepreneurs need to understand that when they come to the bank, the bank's first perspective is looking at the risk, and they have a risk tolerance.
Right.
And certain deals, for example, the restaurant industry is known historically. In fact, that's principally how the Small Business Administration was formed, was because the restaurant industry, that food industry, has the highest default rate of all businesses.
Right, right.
So from a risk standpoint, back to your question, when you come into the bank with a restaurant type of business venture that you're seeking financing, understand that risk tolerance is, I mean, so there's going to be a different risk tolerance than something that the bank is comfortable with.
Right.
And so understanding that profile and understanding even your institution. I mean, some institutions have a greater risk for different types of deals. And trying to understand that is really important. And I think the best, if I can give entrepreneurs any type of advice, have a relationship with your banker before you need the banker.
Right.
Have a relationship. Cultivate that relationship. Get to know them. Help them to get to know you and to know your business.
Right.
And so that when you really have a need, they already have a sensitivity to your business and to your character.
Right.
Because, you know, principally, lending is about the character of the individual.
Mm. Love that.
And so if you have that relationship, then you're establishing that rapport with them. And it makes it a lot different. And it helps, even if your request is marginal or it gets declined, mm-hmm. if the loan officer has a relationship with you, they can advocate better for you.
Right.
So
what happens with a generation that is socially awkward and is using technology to make deposits and withdrawals, right? Because we live in a generation of fast movers and shakers. Wealth management and day trading is huge right now. And so you have young people who say, well, why do I need the bank? I can put my money in a bank and withdraw it and deposit it and not even have to step foot in a bank. Why is it important for me to build these relationships?
I'm not quite there in terms of technology is great, mm-hmm. but online, and that I think that goes back to the difference between a community bank and a local community bank like Liberty
right.
and a larger bank.
Right.
You can do everything virtually,
mm-hmm.
but without that relationship, when you really need help and assistance, you won't have a relationship.
Right.
And virtual, nothing wrong with virtual banks if people want to do that, but I think ultimately it still comes down to you need to cultivate a relationship with your banker because your banker is going to really help you to grow.
Right.
And, you know, without that type of relationship, you know, I don't, you know, it's an interesting dynamic as we move into this new generation, how that happens. But I think ultimately, you know, even being socially awkward, they're going to have to change because customers are, we're relational
mm-hmm.
and customers want relationships.
Right.
And the same is true. You're going to need that clearly in the banking industry. Yeah.
So just to kind of push up against that just a little bit for that generation who believes in Bitcoin and crypto and NFTs. So talk to me a little bit about the threat on banking and the impact on our banking institutions based off of the crypto, NFTs, and Bitcoins that most people are really diving into these days.
So it's interesting because I was at a conference 2 weeks ago and they mm-hmm. talked about Bitcoin. They talked about kind of these emerging monetary systems.
Mm-hmm.
I think kind of on a very high level until the Federal Reserve Bank and Congress gets to understand and regulate that, I think they'll still remain kind of technologies or currencies that are not, that won't be mainstream.
Right.
I particularly don't quite understand it in the sense that, I mean, and I know that that's really kind of competing and pushing up against
right.
The banking industry. When I say I don't understand it, it's like, you know, give me a dollar and I can buy something.
Right.
I mean, so, and I say that, I think it comes down to how can Congress or how can the Federal Reserve regulate it?
Mm.
And if they can't regulate it, can't figure out a way to regulate it, then it won't be mainstreamed.
Right.
And until that happens, it will still be a fringe type of economy.
Right.
And it's just like even the, you know, not to get into this, but just like the cannabis industry,
mm-hmm.
until it gets federally regulated, it's still a fringe. Notwithstanding how much money can be generated, it's still a fringe economy, thereby it's not accepted in the banking industry.
Right. So for those individuals who are in the cannabis industry looking for financial support and funding, what other options do they have outside of these federally regulated laws that won't allow them to really participate in traditional lending?
It's not even lending.
Mm.
I mean, lending's part of it. And I'm sure there's some resources around it. Very few, but it's about the deposits as
right.
well.
Right.
I know of a gentleman that I sit on a board with his son in another state, has a thriving, robust cannabis business as a grower. Mm-hmm. They have to keep money in a safe. He has to keep money. He has to have security guards because that money can't come into the banking system.
Right.
And so it's not just about deposit loans. It's about it impacts your banking side of it.
Right.
Until that gets regulated at the federal level, it will still be a fringe type of business. Even though you have states across the country that are mandating and opening up the channels and legalizing cannabis, banks can't open up deposits. Mm-hmm. Therefore, banks can't lend to those type of industries. And so the only thing you can do is find alternative non-bank lenders to lend that will lend to you. And then deposits, I think it still becomes one of those cash, those transactions that you have to keep a lot of cash secretly under your mattress.
Right. Yeah. Go old school.
Yeah.
Hey,
that's it.
So, before we close out, I want to talk a little bit about the work you've done in mentoring other people and just kind of step outside of your professional role, because oftentimes people see you and your role as, Glenn Davis, the first vice president of Liberty Bank, but they don't see the work that you do behind the scenes for other people, mentoring and coaching others to help equip them with the tools and resources they need to be successful. Talk a little bit about that.
So I've always been a community person. To the audience, I'm also a minister, associate pastor at the First Cathedral in Bloomfield under Archbishop Leroy Bailey and co-pastor Dr. Michael Bailey. So I'm in the community. So I'm touching people at a very personal level. Mm-hmm. So beyond, I love what I do professionally, but more than anything else, I'm a spiritual person.
Right.
And people's needs beyond the physical needs are spiritual needs.
Right.
And so I always try to invest myself in people. I don't think any of us, we would all be blinded if we think we have arrived at whatever stage of life we're on. Mm-hmm. We didn't make it there by ourselves. So people have invested in my life, and I just feel, obligated that I have to invest in other people's lives. So I do that on a consistent basis. My daily prayer is when I wake up is, Lord, I give you praise, and then allow me to be an instrument of your grace, your mercy, and your peace. Because at some point during the course of the day, someone needs God's mercy. And so I need to be an instrument of that mercy.
Right.
I need to be an instrument of God's grace. And so.
I love that. But it doesn't stop there, right? Because you are part of a fraternity.
Oh, yes.
I thought I was getting away with it.
Do we have any fraternity members in the audience? No.
I'm sure.
So, yes. So I'm a member of Kappa Alpha Psi Fraternity Incorporated. Mm-hmm. I won't tell you how long I've been involved and been a member. I'm a neophyte.
Four scores, 7 years ago.
So, yeah. So I do that. And I'm, in addition to Kappa Alpha Psi, I'm also very active on various boards in the community.
And sponsoring a number of these organizations to continue to invest in these young individuals and their mentoring programs.
So I do, part of my role is also to invest and to sponsor organizations across Connecticut and Western Mass. Mm-hmm. That actually do the work. And I think that becomes an extension of my hands, an extension of my reach when I can invest in those.
Yeah, beautiful. Thank you so much for being here and having this conversation with us. Most people don't truly get to see the individuals behind the scenes working and advocating for us. So it was super important for them to see the representation within our communities and the work you're doing for us. So I appreciate you being here with Sheba. Appreciate you being here on the episode of Access to Cap. We love when we can have polished, professional Kappas.
I paid you well.
Come in and talk about all the work they're doing for our people and our communities around economic empowerment and development. Thank you so much. Yeah. And here's another episode of Access to CAP where we have conscious conversations about economic empowerment. Thank you for joining us.
Ask the cap, let me put you on game. On game. Ask the cap, look at all that you could gain. Business moves, loans, and grants, it's all a part of the game. You could learn all of this, let the Queen Sheba explain. Ask the cap, let me put you on game.